make the trip from Le Havre to Paris, following the Seine River through Rouen, where centuries ago Joan of Arc had been burned at the stake. I understand the French so imperfectly as to be uncertain whether those to whom I speak and myself mean the same thing, Jefferson confessed. The language problem meant that he was roundly cheated by porters at several stops. But nothing could spoil the wonder of the French countryside at the start of the harvest season. When they crossed the Seine at the Pont de Neuilly, Jefferson proclaimed it the most beautiful bridge in the world, then rolled onto the Champs-Élysées. He was clearly starting a new chapter in his career as America's minister plenipotentiary to France. We have a much clearer sense of how he looked because his ascending fame made him the subject of several portraits, engravings, and busts during his 5 years in France. The skin on his face was now taut and tight, with a permanently reddish hue that made him always appear as if he had just finished exercising. His hair was now more sandy than red, but just as thick and full as ever, cut so that it covered his ears, then tied in the back so as to fall just below his collar. His frame remained angular, but was now more muscled and less gangly, the product of daily 4 mile walks and a vigorous regimen that included soaking his feet in cold water each morning. In general, he had grown more handsome with age, like one of those gawky and slightly awkward young men who eventually inhabit their features more comfortably with the years. Time had also allowed him to occupy his height in more proper proportions and carry it with more natural grace. He remained a very tall man for his time. We know that when he made his first official appearance with John Adams and Benjamin Franklin at the court at Versailles, the physical contrast struck several observers as almost comical, like watching a cannonball, a teapot, and a candlestick announce themselves as the American Trinity. If aging had served him well physically, perhaps here was underlying reason why Jefferson always thought that the future was on his side, it had also seasoned him psychologically. Many American lives had been caught up in the turmoil of the War for Independence, then deposited on the other side of the historic conflict with scars and wounds that never went away. Though Jefferson never commanded troops or fired a shot in anger, his personal experience during and immediately following the war included two traumatic episodes that toughened him on the inside even more than his marathon walks and cold water baths toughened his body. The first incident occurred during his 2-year term as governor of Virginia from 1779 to 1781. It was the worst possible time for a man who preferred the rarefied atmosphere of scholarship and the study to assume the duties of governor, since wartime exigencies generated massive economic, logistical, and political problems that even the most adroit executive would have found daunting. Despite his best efforts, Virginia's economy became a shambles, and the state failed to meet its quota of men for the Continental Army. Then Jefferson approved an expedition that carried off Virginia's best troops to a futile campaign against Detroit, just before a British invasion force under the command of Benedict Arnold swept in from the Chesapeake Bay and burned the capital at Richmond to the ground. To make matters worse, cavalry detachments from General Cornwallis's army moved against Charlottesville and nearly captured Jefferson himself at Monticello. Stories spread throughout the state of Jefferson's ignominious last-minute escape on horseback, implying rather unfairly that he had behaved in a cowardly fashion, or that he was derelict in his duty by allowing the state to become so vulnerable to British military occupation. The Virginia Assembly even passed a resolution calling for an investigation into his conduct. This was eventually dropped. A final resolution officially absolved him of any wrongdoing. But even though the wartime mishaps were probably beyond his or anybody's control, they had happened on his watch. The stain of failure as an executive never wholly disappeared. All the stories resurfaced when he ran for the presidency in 1796 and again in 1800, and Jefferson himself learned that his refined sensibility was ill-suited for the rigors of leadership during times of crisis. As for the emotional effects, Jefferson confided to a friend that the experience had inflicted a wound on my spirit that will only be cured by the all-healing grave. The second indictment came straight on the heels of the first, and unquestionably constituted the most traumatic experience of his entire life. In May 1782, his wife Martha gave birth for the seventh time in their 10-year marriage. The daughter, named Lucy Elizabeth, was only the third child to survive, and Martha herself fell desperately ill after the delivery. Her delicate disposition had obviously been destroyed by the never-ending pregnancies. She lingered on through the summer, with Jefferson at her bedside nearly around the clock. Family lore, reinforced by reminiscences within the slave community at Monticello, described a melodramatic deathbed scene in which Martha extracted a promise from Jefferson that he would never marry again, allegedly because she did not want her surviving children raised by a stepmother. He never did. She died on September 6, 1782. Jefferson was inconsolable for 6 weeks, sobbing throughout the nights, breaking down whenever he tried to talk. Word of his extended grieving leaked out from Monticello and caused some friends to worry that he was losing his mind. "I never thought him to rank domestic happiness in the first class of the chief good," wrote Edmund Randolph, "but scarcely supposed that his grief would be so violent as to justify the circulating report of his swooning away whenever he sees his children." When he eventually emerged from seclusion to take long rides through the local woods, Patsy became his constant companion in what she later called those melancholy rambles. He agreed to accept the diplomatic post in Paris as part of the effort to move past this tragedy and to escape from his memories of Martha at Monticello, but he was scarred in a place that never completely healed. God had seen fit to reach down into the domestic utopia that he had constructed so carefully and snatch away its centerpiece. Jefferson did not seem to possess any sense of complicity in causing her pregnancies, or any sense of warning as her health deteriorated after each new miscarriage or birth. We cannot know for sure whether, as family tradition tells the story, he promised his dying wife that he would never remarry. The promise he made to himself undoubtedly had the same effect. He would never expose his soul to such pain again. He would rather be lonely than vulnerable. If this, then, was how he looked and, as much as we can ever know, how he felt upon his arrival in Paris in the late summer of 1784, there remains the question of what he thought. His reputation as a political thinker, which did not yet benefit from his authorship of the Declaration of Independence, since that achievement was not yet widely known, was based primarily on his legislative work in the Virginia Assembly and the Federal Congress. From 1776 to 1779, he had almost single-handedly attempted the root and branch reform of the Virginia Legal Code, calling for the abolition of primogeniture and entail as the last vestiges of English feudalism, the reform of the criminal law so as to limit the use of the death penalty, the expansion of the suffrage to include more of the independent yeomen from the western counties, the expansion of the public school system of the state, and, most important, the elimination of the Anglican establishment in favor of a complete separation of church and state. This phenomenal effort at legislative reform proved too visionary for his colleagues in the Virginia Assembly, who defeated all his proposals save the abolition of primogeniture and entail, which was on the verge of dying a natural death anyway. But the thrust of his political thinking was clear: to remove all legal and political barriers to individual initiative and thereby create what he called an opening for the aristocracy of virtue and talent. It was in effect an attempt to implement the ideals articulated in the natural rights section of the Declaration. Just as clearly, his favorite ideas were several steps ahead of public opinion. He was more a prophet than a politician. The same pattern held true in the Federal Congress at Philadelphia. Throughout the winter and spring of 1784, he threw himself into the reform of the coinage system, successfully urging the dollar and decimal units in lieu of the English pound and shilling. He also tried but failed to replace the English system of weights and measures with metric standards. He wrote the Ordinance of 1784, which established the principles on which all new states would be admitted to the Union on an equal basis with existing states. The final provision required the end of slavery in all newly created states by 1800, but it lost by one vote, prompting Jefferson to remark later that the fate of millions unborn was hanging on the tongue of one man, and heaven was silent in that awful moment. It was the most far-reaching proposal to end slavery that Jefferson ever wrote, but also the high watermark of his anti-slavery efforts, which receded afterward to lower levels of caution and procrastination. Throughout the spring of 1784, he expressed frustration with the paralyzing combination of indolence and garrulousness that afflicted the Congress. It was barely possible to muster a quorum to approve the peace treaty ending the war with England. Given his subsequent hostility to consolidated federal power in virtually every form, his impatience at this time with what he called the petty justlings of states stands out as an indication of his temporary willingness to accept federal power as a corrective to local and regional bickering. He confided to friends his conviction that the Articles of Confederation, in giving the federal government power over foreign affairs, had implicitly given it power over all trade and commerce. This endorsement of the doctrine of implied powers came back to haunt him a decade later. He wanted to see treaties of amity and commerce negotiated with European nations, in part for the economic benefits they would generate, but mostly because, as he put it, the moment these treaties are concluded, the jurisdiction of Congress over the commerce of the states springs into existence, and that of the particular states is superseded. To sum up, then, the man riding into Paris as America's minister plenipotentiary was not the same young Virginian who had drafted the Declaration of Independence. He was more famous, more physically impressive, a more confident carrier of his natural assets and abilities. He was more seasoned as a legislator. Though still and always an idealist with greater talent at envisioning what ought to be than skill at leading others toward the future he imagined, he was also more seasoned as a man, less vulnerable and sensitive, because more adroit at protecting his interior regions from intruders by layering his internal defenses in ways that denied access at all checkpoints. This psychological dexterity was to serve him well as a diplomat. Finally, he had managed to combine his utopian vision of an American society of liberated individuals, freely pursuing happiness once the burden of English corruption and European feudalism had been removed, with a more practical recognition that an independent America required some kind of federal government to coordinate its burgeoning energies and excesses. Without surrendering his youthful radicalism, he had also become a dedicated nationalist. Friends and Pirates. Setting himself and his entourage took much longer than he had expected. First, there was the problem of his health, which, except for his recurrent migraine headaches, had always been excellent. But within a few weeks, he came down with a severe cold that he could not shake for 6 months. "I have had a very bad winter," he explained to his friend James Monroe back in Virginia, "having been confined the greatest part of it. A seasoning, as they call it, is the lot of most strangers, and none, I believe, have experienced a more severe one than myself. The air is extremely damp, and the water is very unwholesome. We have had for 3 weeks past a warm visit from the sun, my almighty physician, and I find myself almost reestablished." Though he eventually fell in love with the people, the wine, and the architecture of France, the weather was another matter, causing him to speculate that there was a nearly permanent cloud bank over his section of Western Europe that produced pale and anemic human constitutions. Then there was the problem of the language. Jefferson was justifiably renowned for his facility with foreign languages, which included Latin, Greek, French, and Italian. He even claimed that he had taught himself Spanish on the voyage to France by reading Don Quixote with the aid of a grammar book. Years later, when he was president, Jefferson recalled the incident over dinner. John Quincy Adams, who was present at the dinner party with the president, recorded the claim in his memoirs, then added, "But Mr. Jefferson tells large stories." The truth seems to be that Jefferson was adept at learning how to read foreign languages, but not to speak or write them. Even after 5 years in France, his spoken French never reached a sufficient level of fluency to permit comfortable conversation, and he never trusted his written French sufficiently to dispense with a translator for his formal correspondence. Finally, there was the problem of where to live. He shuttled among a series of hotels for the first few months, then, in October 1784, signed a lease for a villa at Cul-de-sac Thébu on the right bank. But this proved inadequate and inconvenient, so he moved the following year to the Hôtel de Longiac on the Champs-Élysées near the present-day Arc de Triomphe, then on the outskirts of the city. He rented the entire building, a fashionable and spacious three-story dwelling originally built for the mistress of a French nobleman. This became his Parisian Monticello, complete with several salons, three separate suites, stables, a garden, and a full staff of servants, maids, cooks, plus a coachman and a gardener. It was lavish and expensive. The rent and furniture exceeded his annual salary of $9,000, but what he required to feel at home abroad. When all the arrangements were finally completed, Jefferson had constructed an extensive support system of servants, secretaries, and acolytes that afforded him the same kind of physical and emotional protection that he had enjoyed on his Virginia plantation. At the center of the household stood Jefferson himself. Patsy had been placed in a convent school, the Abbey Royal de Pentemont, which Jefferson was assured and frequently felt the need to reassure himself was renowned for its liberal attitude toward non-Catholic students. She was home only on special weekends. The inner circle of defense was manned by James Hemings, who was Jefferson's personal servant when not attending culinary classes, and Adrian Petit, the supremely competent overseer of all household affairs and employees. The next ring of protection handled political and diplomatic issues. It was managed by two secretaries, David Humphreys, the 32-year-old Connecticut poet who had served on George Washington's staff during the war and had now attached himself to Jefferson as the fastest-rising star in American statecraft, and William Short, a 25-year-old law student, a graduate of William and Mary, Jefferson's in-law, protege, and all-purpose political handyman. The outer perimeter of counsel and comfort lay back in America. In effect, a series of listening posts in Virginia and the Congress at Philadelphia, from which James Madison and James Monroe delivered regular reports, often using a ciphered code to conceal sensitive information. Taken together, Madison, Monroe, and Short represented that segment of the younger generation of political talent in Virginia that had come to regard Jefferson as its titular leader. Each was almost old enough to be his younger brother and almost young enough to be his son. The correspondence with Madison proved to be the start of a 50-year partnership, perhaps unique in American history, in which Madison was the ever-loyal junior member. Madison succeeded Jefferson in the presidency, then Monroe succeeded Madison, thereby occupying the office with Jeffersonians for the first 24 years of the 19th century. Jefferson cultivated all three of these young Virginians as his protégés, even envisioning the day when they would live next to him at Monticello. In February 1784, he shared the dream with Madison. "Monroe is buying land almost adjoining me. Short will do the same. What would I not give you could fall into the circle. With such a society, I could once more venture home and lay myself up for the residue of life, quitting all contentions which grow daily more and more insupportable. Think of it. To render it practicable only requires you to think it so." Part Praetorian Guard, part quasi-members of his extended family, these younger Virginians had already identified Jefferson as the heir apparent to Washington in the line of succession of state and national leadership. Much of Jefferson's first year in France was spent establishing the communications network of this looming Virginia dynasty. The settling process during that first year included one final variable of long-term historical significance: Jefferson's relationship with the Adams family. When news reached John Adams of Jefferson's appointment, he let out word that he was pleased. "Jefferson is an excellent hand," he noted to friends back in New England. "You could not have sent better." When some members of Congress expressed concern about Jefferson's excessive idealism, Adams would have none of it. my fellow laborer in Congress 8 or 9 years ago, upon many arduous trials, particularly in the draft of the Declaration of Independence, I have found him uniformly the same wise and prudent man and steady patriot. Adams's wife, Abigail, and their daughter, called Nabby, had joined him and their son, John Quincy, the same week that Jefferson had arrived in France. For 9 months until Adams was dispatched to London as America's first ambassador to the court of St. James, the Adams quarters at Oti became Jefferson's second home. More than 50 years later, and after a phase of bitter political disagreements that seriously frayed their friendship, Adams still recalled this time with fondness. Upon John Quincy's election as president in 1824, for example, Adams reminded Jefferson that our John had won. "I call him our John," he explained, "because when you was at Cul-de-sac in Paris, he appeared to be almost as much your boy as mine." The special relationship between Adams and Jefferson had its origins in their political partnership of 1776, but the deep emotional bonding between the two men occurred in France in 1784-85. Abigail Adams played a crucial role. Jefferson's first winter in Paris was one long and nearly debilitating illness. His recovery during the spring occurred under her watchful eye, and then with the whole Adams family in their parlor, swapping anecdotes and opinions about the whole range of diplomatic and domestic subjects. Abigail was the link between questions of foreign policy and family priorities. Probably the first woman Jefferson came to know well, who combined the traditional virtues of a wife and mother with the sharp mind and tongue of a fully empowered accomplice in her husband's career. Jefferson had always regarded these different assets as inhabiting distinct and separate spheres that God or nature had somehow seen fit to keep apart. In Abigail, however, they came together. She was Martha with a mind of her own. Transcripts of those afternoon conversations, needless to say, do not exist, but the character and quality of the free-flowing banter survive in the playful letters exchanged after the Adams family moved to London. First, there was the bond of mutual admiration and jocular courting. Abigail asked Jefferson to purchase several small replicas of classical beauty. Jefferson responded, "With respect to the figures, I could only find 3 of those you named matched in size. These were Minerva, Diana, and Apollo. I was obliged to add a 4th, unguided by your choice. They offered me a fine Venus, but I thought it out of taste to have 2 at table at the same time." Or Abigail requested Jefferson to survey the Parisian shops for black lace and evening shoes, apologizing at the end for troubling you with such trifling matters, which was a little like putting Hercules to the distaff. Then there was the running joke about the inherent depravity of the English monarch and nation. Jefferson reported, "A blind story here of somebody attempting to assassinate your king, i.e. George III. No man upon earth has my prayers for his continuance in life more sincerely than him. He is truly the American Messiah's." Abigail observed that all stories originating in the English newspapers were lies. "The account is as false, if it was not too rough a term for a lady to use, I would say false as hell, but I would substitute one not less expressive and say false as English." Jefferson asked her if there was anything he could do in his official capacity to improve English manners. Abigail informed him that there is a want of many French commodities, good sense, good nature, political wisdom, and benevolence. Jefferson would render essential service to His Britannic Majesty if he would permit cargoes of this kind to be exported into this kingdom. Finally, there was the matter of Jefferson's parental responsibilities. The Adamses were still in Paris when Jefferson received word that Lucy, his youngest child and the daughter whose birth had led to Martha's fatal illness, had herself died of whooping cough back in Virginia. Abigail helped console Jefferson. He went into a deep despondency, and they developed a special affinity as parents. When her own daughter, Nabby, announced her intention to marry Colonel Stephen Smith, the personal secretary to husband John, Abigail proposed a unique arrangement to Jefferson. Now I have been thinking of an exchange with you, sir. Suppose you give me Miss Jefferson, Patsy, and in some future date take a son, her grandson, in lieu of her. I am for strengthening the Federal Union. But most of Abigail's maternal advice concerned Jefferson's middle daughter, Maria, called Polly. Jefferson had left her with relatives back in Virginia. She was only 4 years old, and in part because of Abigail's prodding, he decided to risk the Atlantic voyage and have her sent over to Paris to consolidate his family. Abigail was at the wharf in London when Polly arrived and immediately began to initiate Jefferson in the time-honored Adams tradition of brutal honesty. Polly herself was an absolute charmer. "I never saw so intelligent a countenance in a child before," Abigail wrote, "and the pleasure she has given me is an ample compensation for any little services I have been able to render her." But Jefferson needed to face his failures as a father. "I show her your picture. She says she cannot know it. How could she when she could not know you?" When Jefferson wrote to say that official duties prevented him from crossing the channel to fetch Polly, so he was sending Petite, his chief household servant, Abigail felt obliged to insist that Jefferson contemplate Polly's reaction to this news. "Though she says she does not remember you, yet she has been taught to consider you with affection and fondness, and depended upon your coming for her. She told me this morning that as she had left all her friends in Virginia to come over the ocean to see you, she did think you would have taken the pains to have come here for her, and not have sent a man, Petit, whom she cannot understand. I express her own words." As if this were not enough, Abigail wondered out loud how a man who professed to feel such affection for his children could then commit them to the care of Catholic nuns. The decision to place Patsy in the convent at Pantemont had always mystified her. Now that Polly had finally joined her father, "I hope that she will not lose her fine spirits within the walls of a convent, too, to which I own I have many, perhaps, false prejudices." Jefferson's relationship with John Adams also mingled deep and mutual affection, with a level of bracing honesty from the Adams side that frequently forced Jefferson to face the persistent gap between his ideals and the messier realities of the real world. Jefferson, for his part, provided Adams with an extremely thoughtful and hard-working partner in the business of representing America's interest in Europe. Abigail claimed that Jefferson was "the only person with whom my companion could associate with perfect freedom and unreserve." Taken together, the two men were the proverbial opposites that attracted: the stout, candid to a fault New Englander, with the effusive temperament and the pugilistic disposition, and the lean, ever-elusive Virginian, with the glacial exterior and almost eerie serenity. Each man seemed to sense in the other the compensating qualities missing in his own personality. In the amiable atmosphere created by Abigail at Oti, they found the leisured conditions that allowed them to appreciate the attractiveness of their respective other sides, completing each other, if you will, and creating a truly formidable diplomatic team in the process. As distinctive products of the war for independence, they shared a bottomless commitment to the prospects for an independent American nation and an equally limitless mistrust of English policy toward its former colonies. Jefferson claimed that he had an infallible rule for deciding what that nation, England, would do on every occasion. It was a simple rule, namely, to consider what they ought to do and to take the reverse of that as what they would assuredly do. He claimed that, by adopting this formula, he was never deceived. Adams concurred completely. "If John Bull don't see a thing at first," he observed to Jefferson, "you know it is a rule with him ever afterwards to swear that it don't exist, even when he does both see it and feel it." Adams believed that the loss of the war with America, and with it a substantial portion of their overseas empire, had rendered most Englishmen incapable of fair-mindedness toward their former colonies. "They care no more for us," he concluded, "than they do about the Seminole Indians." There was even a dramatic, almost melodramatic moment when their mutual Anglophobia was sealed in a symbolic blood oath. When Jefferson visited Adams in England in the spring of 1786, The two former revolutionaries were presented at court, and George III ostentatiously turned his back on both of them. Neither man ever forgot the insult or the friend standing next to him when it happened. In addition to their mutual animosities toward England and their common sense of indignation at the insufferable arrogance of the king, the friendship worked because Jefferson deferred to Adams. After all, Adams was his senior and had been negotiating with the French and English for 5 years. Jefferson's deferential pattern began as soon as he arrived in France. "What would you think of the enclosed draft to be proposed to the courts of London and Versailles?" Jefferson inquired. "I know it goes beyond our powers, and beyond the powers of Congress, too, but it is so evidently for the good of the states that I should not be afraid to risk myself on it if you are of the same opinion." The proposal envisioned reciprocal rights for citizens of all nations, complete freedom of trade, and a reformed system of international law. "Yes," Adams replied, "it was a beau ideal proposal, but unfortunately it was also completely irrelevant to the current and cutthroat European context. We must not, my friend, be the bubbles of our own liberal sentiments. If we cannot obtain reciprocal liberality, we must adopt reciprocal prohibitions, exclusions, monopolies, and imposts. Our offers have been fair, more than fair. If they are rejected, we must not be dupes." The same pattern repeated itself in the dialogue over American policy toward the vexing problem of the Barbary pirates. Several Muslim countries along the North African coast had established the tradition of plundering the ships of European and American merchants in the Western Mediterranean and Eastern Atlantic, capturing the crews and then demanding ransom from the respective governments for their release. In a joint message to their superiors in Congress, Adams and Jefferson described the audacity of these terrorist attacks, pirates leaping onto defenseless ships with daggers clenched in their teeth. They had asked the ambassador from Tripoli, Adams and Jefferson explained, on what grounds these outrageous acts of unbridled savagery could be justified. The ambassador answered us that it was founded on the laws of the Prophet, that it was written in their Quran, that all nations who should not have acknowledged their authority were sinners, that it was their right and duty to make war upon them wherever they could be found, and to make slaves of all they could take as prisoners. Jefferson found such unmitigated blackmail beyond his comprehension and beyond any recognized principle of law or justice. He initially proposed that the United States refuse to pay ransoms and instead dispatch a naval force to the Mediterranean to teach these outlaws of the sea a lesson. Later, he supplemented his proposal with a comprehensive scheme whereby the United States would organize an international task force comprised of all European nations whose shipping was being victimized. "Justice and honor favor this course," he exclaimed to Adams, "and it would probably cost less in the long run to boot." Adams agreed that it was impossible to negotiate with the Barbary pirates. As he put it, "Avarice and fear are the only agents at Algiers." But Jefferson's accounting, Adams observed, grossly underestimated the cost. It would require at least £500,000 annually to sustain a naval force in the region. The Congress would never authorize such a sum, and the United States had nothing in the way of a navy to send over anyway. "From these premises," he apprised Jefferson, "I conclude it to be wisest for us to negotiate and pay the necessary sum without loss of time." Adams insisted that Jefferson's solution, while bold and wholly honorable in its own terms, was an idea whose time had not come. "Congress will never, or at least not for years, take any such resolution," he reminded Jefferson, "and in the meantime our trade and honor suffers beyond calculation. We ought not to fight them at all unless we determine to fight them forever." Jefferson remained unconvinced, but agreed that Adams' opinion should be the basis for the official American position. "You take the result differently from what I do," he wrote to Adams in London, "but it is of no consequence, as I have nothing to say in the decision." It is possible to detect in Jefferson an early undertone of resentment toward Adams's realism, which consistently undercut his own grander vision. Jefferson even tried to go over Adams's head by having his own proposal for an international naval force presented to Congress by a third party, a ploy that failed when Congress rejected the scheme outright, as Adams had predicted it would. If one were looking for early signs of the eventual clash between these longtime colleagues, one could find them in embryo here. But Jefferson's momentary duplicities were more than overbalanced by his genuine admiration for Adams. The admiration went even deeper, to the recognition that Adams possessed a mental toughness, a capacity to flourish in the midst of innuendo and invective and high-stakes decisions. "Indeed, the man must be a rock," Jefferson wrote to Abigail, "who can stand all this." He went on to confess his own sense of inadequacy in embattled situations and to hold up Adams as a mentor. "I do not love difficulties. I am fond of quiet, willing to do my duty, but irritable by slander and apt to be forced by it from my post. These are weaknesses from which reason and your counsels will preserve Mr. Adams." Diplomatic futilities. There was, of course, a third American minister in France, more famous by far than the other two. Benjamin Franklin had been representing American interests abroad longer than any other diplomat, and his reputation in France had reached epic proportions. He was the visible embodiment of American values in their most seductively simple form. When Franklin and Voltaire had embraced before the multitudes of Paris, it created a sensation in the French press, the union of the two greatest champions of human enlightenment in history's most enlightened century. Jefferson himself regarded Franklin as second only to Washington as the greatest American of the revolutionary generation, going so far as to observe that there was a discernible gap between Franklin and their next tier of American revolutionary heroes, a group in which he included Adams but modestly excluded himself. Unofficial rumors had it that Jefferson had been appointed Franklin's eventual replacement. Franklin, who was nearing 80, had let it be known that he wished to return to America in the near future. When Jefferson was presented to the court soon after his arrival, legend has it that Vergennes, the French foreign minister, asked him if he was intended to serve as Franklin's replacement, to which Jefferson allegedly replied, "No one can replace him, sir. I am only his successor." Adams, for his part, was far from saddened to see Franklin leave. The two men had quarreled incessantly throughout the negotiations that produced the Treaty of Paris, 1783, ending the war. Adams contending that Franklin left the bulk of the work for him, shared American negotiating secrets too freely with Vergennes, and too often mistook flirtatious evenings with admiring French ladies for his main diplomatic duties. Franklin, in turn, regarded Adams as the kind of neurotic Yankee who gave hard work a bad name and who failed to appreciate the benefits of informal associations with France's Salon Society, especially the sort of harmless flirtations of an old man with the lovely and once lovely women who helped shape the values of Parisian culture. No one, not even Jefferson, could turn a phrase as deftly as Franklin. His characterization of Adams became famous in its own day, then with posterity, as the ultimate one-sentence evisceration. "Always an honest man, often a wise one, but sometimes, and in some things, absolutely out of his senses." For the brief time that they were together as a ministerial team, Jefferson served as a valuable buffer between the two senior members, both of whom found him likable and dedicated. Indeed, it is possible to argue without much fear of contradiction that during the 9 months Adams, Franklin, and Jefferson represented American interests in France, the United States enjoyed the greatest assemblage of sheer intellectual talent in the whole subsequent history of American diplomacy. Their chief problem, then, was hardly a lack of wisdom or skill. It was simply that there was very little for them to accomplish. When all was said and done, there were very few European countries with much interest in signing treaties of amity and commerce with the recently established American Republic. Franklin possessed the most exquisite sense of timing of any member of the revolutionary era, His departure in the summer of 1785 signaled the end of prospects for the American cause in Europe. He arrived back in Philadelphia in plenty of time to participate in the deliberations of the Constitutional Convention. Adams complained that there was little for him to do in Paris or London. He spent the bulk of his time composing a massive three-volume study of political theory entitled A Defense of the Constitutions of the United States. Although Jefferson was fully engaged by routine diplomatic duties throughout his years in France, the strategic situation in which fate and the American Congress had placed him virtually precluded any significant foreign policy achievements on his watch. Although there were, in fact, several overlapping layers of insurmountable difficulty, the chief problem lay back in Philadelphia. To put it most concisely, the Federal Congress created under the Articles of Confederation lacked sufficient authority to oversee American foreign policy. A typical letter from John Jay, who had responsibility for foreign affairs, reported the chronic condition of gridlock. "It has happened from various circumstances," Jay wrote to Jefferson, "that several reports on foreign affairs still lay before Congress undecided upon. The want of an adequate representation for long intervals has occasioned delays and omissions which, however unavoidable, are much to be regretted." Jefferson was particularly incensed when the Congress dismissed his plan for a naval force to destroy the Barbary pirates as impossibly expensive. "It will be said," he wrote to Monroe, "there is no money in the Treasury. There never will be money in the Treasury till the Confederacy shows its teeth. The states must see the rod." But Madison informed him that the will to pass revenue bills was simply non-existent. The current revenue in the Treasury amounted to less than $400,000, which was not enough to pay off old debts, much less take on new ones. Madison agreed that it was a lamentable situation that would confirm all the world in the belief that we are not to be respected, nor apprehended as a nation in matters of commerce. The outstanding debt to France particularly grated on Jefferson, since he was constantly besieged by French veterans of the American Revolution for the back pay owed them. But apart from shaking his head in a gesture of consolation and disbelief, there was absolutely nothing he could do about it. Then there was the intractable problem of English arrogance. David Hartley, an English diplomat more disposed toward America than his colleagues, put the matter squarely to Jefferson. "An English proverb says losers have a right to complain," wrote Hartley. "After a storm, the waves will continue to roll for some time." In short, having lost half its empire in a long and unsuccessful war, England was not about to render one iota of economic assistance to its former colonies. During his visit with Adams in London in the spring of 1786, Jefferson confirmed this prevailing attitude. "With this nation nothing is done, and it is now decided that they intend to do nothing with us. The king is against change of measures, his ministers are against it, and the merchants and people are against it. They sufficiently value our commerce, but they are quite persuaded they shall enjoy it on their own terms." Sadly enough, English presumption was proving correct, since the British continued to control more than 80% of America's foreign trade. Why should they negotiate new commercial treaties with the Americans when they already enjoyed a monopoly on their own terms? To make matters worse, the English were fond of raising awkward questions about the power of American diplomats to negotiate on behalf of the United States, asking rhetorically and mischievously if the federal government actually possessed sovereign power over the respective states. Meanwhile, the English press kept up a steady stream of anti-American sentiment, suggesting that the former colonies were in a condition of near anarchy. Jefferson was especially amused by false reports in the London papers that Franklin had either been captured by Algerian pirates on his return voyage or had been stoned by mobs upon landing in Philadelphia. The dominant opinion among the English aristocracy in their private clubs, Jefferson observed cynically, was that America was poised to petition for readmission into the British Empire. One could hardly expect any cooperation from this quarter. By all accounts, and certainly by Jefferson's initial reckoning, France should have been different. France, after all, was America's major European ally, its source of salvation in the war for independence, the inveterate enemy of England and home for philosophies who shared Jefferson's liberal faith in open markets and free trade. Jefferson drafted many lengthy memoranda designed to persuade the French ministry that if the United States and France could reach reciprocal agreements whereby all tariffs and duties were abolished between their respective countries, the net result would be a bonanza of cheaper raw materials for France and an equivalent cornucopia of cheaper manufactured goods for America. Moreover, the chief victim of this new arrangement would be their common enemy, England. But once again, the theoretical beauty of Jefferson's liberal vision ran afoul of mundane realities. This time, in the court politics of Paris and Versailles and the entrenched bureaucracies of French provincial governments. Despite the rational appeal of Jefferson's vision of open markets, he was forced to acknowledge that it seems to walk before us like our shadows, always appearing in reach, yet never overtaken. The best example of the problem was the tobacco monopoly maintained in the highly organized and deeply entrenched agricultural lobby known as the Farmers General, which insisted on high duties for foreign imports in order to protect its own domestic products, as well as line the pockets of its many customs officers. The abolition of the monopoly of our tobacco in the hands of the Farmers General will be pushed by us with all our force, Jefferson wrote in coded language to Monroe. But it is so interwoven with the very formulations of their system of finance that it is of doubtful event. John Jay wrote from Philadelphia to commiserate with Jefferson, recalling that during his own service in France, he had heard the system of complex regulations and clandestine payoffs censured by almost every gentleman whom I heard speak of it. And yet it seems so firmly fixed, perhaps by golden rivulets, even of sovereignty itself, as that the speedy destruction of it seems rather to be wished for than expected. Even when Jefferson was able to persuade the French ministry to agree to modest reductions in the duties on tobacco, the political power of the Farmers General blocked implementation. "I am unable to answer those agents," Jefferson complained, "who inform me that the officers of the customs and farms do not yet consider themselves bound to the new regulations." The bureaucracy, not the government, seemed to be in charge. Throughout his tenure in Paris, Jefferson continued to draft lengthy and elaborate proposals condemning the inherent irrationality of the established system and describing in considerable detail the mutual advantages of a free trade policy. But like a Socratic argument for justice made to representatives of the mafia, it all came to nothing. His only successor after 5 years of relentless effort was a slight reduction in the tariff on American whale oil. The major diplomatic achievement of his stay in France was a $400,000 loan from Dutch bankers done in collusion with Adams in the spring of 1787. The loan was significant because it allowed the American government to consolidate its European debts, thereby creating a source of funding to ransom American captives in Algiers and make regular payments to French veterans of the American Revolution. Jefferson took considerable pleasure in the deal, since it provided a semblance of fiscal responsibility for America's European creditors, but he acknowledged that he was a passive accomplice in the negotiations, which were handled primarily by Adams. In fact, Jefferson confessed that the intricacies of high finance involving floating bond rates and multiple interest charges left him feeling confused and uncomfortable. He trusted Adams's judgment on such matters more than his own. When Adams prepared to depart London for America, he passed along to Jefferson responsibility for the Dutch loan, warning him to be on guard against the unmeasurable avarice of Amsterdam. At just that moment, the Dutch bankers threatened to increase the interest rates on the loan, and Adams worried out loud to Jefferson that they were doing so because they sensed that the American minister to France did not really understand the intricacies of the financing agreement. "I pity you in your situation," Adams wrote to Jefferson. "Dunned and teased as you will be, all your philosophy will be wanting to support you." "Just remember one thing," Adams advised. The Amsterdammers love money too well to execute their threats. Jefferson listened to this advice. The loan was not renegotiated, and American credit in the capitals and markets of Europe improved. All the forward-looking Jeffersonian visions of a liberal international community, comprised of open markets and national cooperation, had foundered on the rocks of European intransigence. From a historical perspective, his lifelong recognition that American foreign policy was the one area requiring a strong federal government congealed at this time. It was also becoming clear that his own idealistic instincts worked best when surrounded by more realistic and tough-minded colleagues. Ironically, the major substantive success of his tenure was a hard-headed financial arrangement with the Amsterdam bankers that, as he freely admitted, he never fully understood. Voice of America. Of course, diplomacy entailed much more than negotiating treaties. The departure of Franklin for America in the summer of 1785 left Jefferson as the ranking American minister at the court of Versailles. Like Franklin, Jefferson was the beneficiary of France's apparently irresistible urge to project onto its premier American resident the Gallic version of the American essence. Jefferson's reputation as a younger Franklin with a southern accent received a boost when the Marquis de Chesilux published an account of his travels in America that featured a romantic sketch of Jefferson at Monticello. It seemed as if from his youth, Chesilux wrote, Jefferson had placed his mind, as he had done his house, on an elevated situation from which he might contemplate the universe. Back in America, he was only beginning to be known beyond the borders of Virginia. The American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia seemed to confirm Chesilux's estimate by electing Jefferson one of its members in 1786. Yale College followed suit by awarding him an honorary Doctor of Law degree the same year. American visitors to Paris further reinforced his emerging reputation by describing Jefferson's infinite composure and aristocratic bearing at court sessions in Versailles. Whereas Franklin's fame in France merely intensified his established reputation in America, Jefferson's budding prominence in Paris served to create his image as a great American, which then migrated back to America with all the prestige of European recognition. He became the primary conduit for the Franco-American cultural exchange. The French had never seen wild honeysuckle or swamp laurel, so seeds should be sent over from Virginia for planting in French soil. The Americans, for their part, needed to know of French experiments in the new science of air travel or ballooning, to include the several calamitous failures when, at the height of about 6,000 feet, some accident happened, and the unfortunate aviators fell from that height and were crushed to atoms. Meanwhile, the French reading public, which was so deprived of news from America that, as Jefferson put it, we might as well be on the moon, received the benefit of Jefferson's editorial additions to the Encyclopédie Méthodique. There he corrected several factual errors in the French accounts of the American Revolution, predicted that the unfortunate institution of slavery was slowly but surely dying out, that emancipation will take place there at some point not very distant, and envisioned the entire North American continent occupied by American settlers within 40 years. He saw to it that France's premier sculptor, Jean-Antoine Houdot, was dispatched to Mount Vernon to do the casts for the definitive sculptures of George Washington. He requested, in fact, ordered that all work cease on the new Virginia capital at Richmond so that the builders could work from an architectural model he was sending over. It was based on the Maison Corée at Nîmes in southern France, what he called the best morsel of ancient architecture now remaining. When it came to architectural matters, Jefferson was utterly unambiguous. The Richmond builders needed to tear down what they had constructed and start again, using the designs he was providing. They are simple and sublime. More cannot be said. They are not the brat of whimsical conception never before brought to light, but copied from the most precious, the most perfect model of ancient architecture remaining on earth. The Virginia Assembly, acknowledging his discerning architectural eye and uncompromising tone, did precisely as it was told. Finally, and rather comically, Jefferson decided to refute the leading French naturalist of the day, Georges de Buffon, who had argued that the mammals and plants of North America were inferior in size, health, and variety to those of Europe. Buffon's theory, silly as it sounds today, benefited from his reputation as France's premier natural scientist. It also had the disarming implication of rendering the entire American environment as fatally degenerate, a kind of laboratory for the corruptive process. Jefferson launched an all-out campaign to gather specimens of American animals that were larger than anything in Europe. Sparing no expense, he commissioned an expedition into the White Mountains of New Hampshire to obtain the skin, the skeleton, and the horns of the moose, the caribou, and the original, or elk. The hunters were ordered to leave the hoof on, to leave the bones of the legs and the thighs if possible, and the skin with the horns on, so that by sewing up the neck and belly of the skin, we should have the true form and size of the animal. The expedition produced the desired specimens, but Jefferson was disappointed in their lack of size, especially the moose, which he had counted on as the trump card to play against Buffon's puny European deer. So another hunting party went out, another moose was killed, another carcass was shipped over to Paris, where Jefferson put it on display in the entry hall of his hotel, still somewhat frustrated that the moose was only 7 feet tall and that its hair kept falling out. Buffon, who was himself a minuscule man less than 5 feet tall, was invited to observe this smelly and somewhat imperfect trophy, but concluded it was insufficient evidence to force a revision of his anti-American theory. It was one of the few occasions when Jefferson failed to enhance mutual understanding along the Franco-American axis. His unqualified success as the most visible American in Paris derived in great part from his outspoken affection for all things French. His abiding awkwardness with spoken French could be forgiven as the single stain on an otherwise spotless record of Francophilia. French wine, French food, French architecture, and the discreet charms of French society were all obvious sources of pleasure for the American minister to the court at Versailles. His equally obvious hatred of England also helped the cause, and he let it be known throughout Parisian society that though he had been born a Virginian, France was his adopted home, just as the French people were his brethren in spirit, if not in blood. "I am much pleased with the people of this country," he wrote in a typical expression of endearment, noting that their inherent civility and sophistication allowed one to glide through a whole life among them without a jostle. This was a sincere sentiment, an authentic expression of genuine affinity between the urbane and cosmopolitan side of his character and the almost sensual seductions of the cultural capital of Europe. But it coexisted alongside its diametric opposite. In letters to friends and colleagues back in America, or in advisory notes to Americans traveling in Europe, Jefferson described France and Europe more generally as a hopeless sinkhole of avarice, ignorance, and abject poverty. Indeed, what Buffon had said about the inherently degenerative conditions of America, Jefferson turned against Europe and, inverting Buffon's prejudices, developed a formulaic argument about European inferiority. The argument tended to take the familiar Jeffersonian form of a dichotomy between moral polarities. "The comparison of our governments in America with those of Europe," he wrote typically, "are like a comparison of heaven to hell." England served as a kind of limbo or intermediate station. When George Wythe wrote him in 1786 to report the good news that the Virginia Assembly had finally passed his bill guaranteeing religious freedom, Jefferson reacted by contrasting what was possible in America with European hopelessness. "If all the sovereigns of Europe were to set themselves to work to emancipate the minds of their subjects from their present ignorance and prejudices, 1,000 years would not place them on the high ground on which our common people are now setting out. If anybody thinks that kings, nobles, or priests are good conservators of the public happiness, send them here." This became a common theme in his letters to American correspondents. If any of our countrymen wish for a king, he wrote to David Ramsay in South Carolina, give them Aesop's fable of the frogs who asked for a king. If this does not cure them, send them to Europe. The Europeans are governments of kites over pigeons, he reported to John Rutledge, adding cynically that the best schools for republicanism are London, Versailles, Madrid, Vienna, Berlin, etc. In a privately circulated document entitled Hints to Americans Traveling in Europe, he criticized those tourists who were overly impressed with the art and monuments of European capitals, concluding that they are worth seeing, but not studying, because they tended to distract attention from the real and deep social corruption of urban life throughout Europe. He urged young men who were embarking on some version of the Grand Tour to beware of the temptations and sexual traps they would encounter. His own secretary, William Short, was engaged in a passionate affair with the beautiful young wife of the Duc de la Rochefoucauld. The typical young traveler is led by the strongest of all human passions into a spirit for female intrigue destructive of his own and others' happiness, or a passion for whores destructive of his health. Paris, he warned, was one huge fleshpot. The psychological agility required to sustain a sincere and highly visible affection for all things French, especially while simultaneously denouncing European decadence with equivalent sincerity, depended upon mysterious mechanisms inside Jefferson that prevented his different voices from hearing one another. In his letters, he could modulate his message to fit his different audiences. The publication of his Notes on the State of Virginia created some intriguing problems on this score because, unlike private letters, one could not control its distribution. It could be read by anybody and everybody. Part travel guide, part scientific treatise, and part philosophical meditation, Notes had been written in the fall of 1781, just after his unfortunate experience as governor of Virginia and just before the tragic death of his wife. It permitted publication of a French translation, albeit without his name on the cover, and in a limited edition of 200 copies, in order to enhance French knowledge of America, and this only after he had learned that an unauthorized version was already in press. Indeed, despite his effort at anonymity, the fact that the American minister to France was the author of Notes quickly became an open secret throughout Parisian society and contributed significantly to his growing reputation as the dominant voice of America in Europe. Abigail and John Adams read it in their coach riding to Calais on the way to their new post in London. I thank you kindly for your book, Adams noted, adding that it is our meditation all the day long. I cannot now say much about it, but I think it will do its author and his country great honor. The passages upon slavery are worth diamonds. They will have more effect than the volumes written by mere philosophers. But Jefferson, in fact, was deeply worried about the effect his remarks on slavery might have on his reputation back in America, especially in Virginia. He confided to Madison that there are sentiments on some subjects which I apprehend ought to be displeasing to the country, and perhaps to the Virginia Assembly, or to some who lead it. I do not wish to be exposed to their censure. Madison wrote back with a cautiously optimistic message, and in a highly elliptical style designed to prevent snoopers at the respective postal offices, even if they managed to decode his cipher, from understanding what he was talking about. I have found the copy of your notes, looked them over carefully myself, and consulted several judicious friends in confidence. We are all sensible that the freedom of your strictures on some particular measures and opinions will displease their respective abettors, but we equally concur in thinking that this consideration ought not be weighed against the utility of your plan. Actually, Jefferson's personal belief that slavery was morally incompatible with the principles of the American Revolution was not cause for worry. He had made his position on that controversial subject known on several occasions in the Virginia Assembly and the Federal Congress. What did merit worry,